nurse oncology libraries, recruiting minority nurses, gaming technology in diagnosis education, and we'll visit with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center on overdoses where one pill can kill. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Hey, good day, and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, the podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome and thank you all for checking out the show this week. We're going to be getting into some things in the nursing news items, including a look at how nurses are leading the way in creation of online health information libraries for things like cancer treatment. Then in this week's special tips segment, we're going to have our good friend Lisa Booz, pharmacist and educator from the Maryland Poison Center, come back on the show and talk to us about a specifically dangerous type of overdose. These are often called one-pill killers in the poison control world, so we'll find out more about that in this week's tips segment. That'll be coming up later on in the show after this week's news. Before we get to the news, though, I do want to make sure you follow up on all of the information you get from this and, of course, every episode. And you can do that by heading over to nursingshow.com, where you can check out the links in each episode's show notes page. There are also other articles and links to other things, like our free Nursing Show mobile app, where you can get the podcast delivered to your mobile device, student nurse tips, and more. So do that. Make sure you get over there. Follow up on the information you get each week in the show and understand how it applies to your own nursing scope of practice. If you want to get back in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. You can always drop me an email. Send them in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I make sure I respond back to every email that comes in. So send me things, links to news items you'd like me to cover, interview suggestions with you or somebody you know. Whatever the case may be, please keep those emails coming. I love to get them. That's it. I'll have some more contact information coming up later on in this episode, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's news items, and that is coming right up. Starting off the nursing news this week is a look at what four oncology nurses are now doing with their time in the private sector. Four Philadelphia nurses recently joined healthcare IT company Evidi Incorporated. They are part of an effort there to create the largest and most comprehensive cancer medicine libraries online. Now, this evidence-based online library would hold information on thousands of cancer treatments and also track current and past clinical research trials in order to keep track of cancer research findings and trends. The nurses will act as case managers for the research compiled in the library, compiling the evidence-based research and vetting the information along with the company's chief medical officer. And this will be done before the information is added to the library. The goal is to create a one-stop comprehensive resource for cancer diagnosis, treatment, and management to be used by oncology healthcare professionals worldwide. This library will provide nurses and doctors the comprehensive drug and treatment information they need, including adverse effects, precautions, and patient management tips that will give them helpful information for their patients to take care of themselves and to take care of their patients. Now, before this library, it would have been nearly impossible for an oncology nurse to keep track of all the latest research or new drugs coming on the market. I'm really looking forward to more of these types of technologies being applied to the healthcare marketplace in order to give us the power of computers and vast databases to gather the real information we need in the clinical environment. It's great to see, though, that nurses are vital partners in these efforts. So I'll stay on top of these things, and I'll bring you more stories about them as they are developed. Next up in this week's news for nurses, I found an article over at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation site, which does a lot to support nurses and the nursing profession. According to the article and research from the foundation, Latinos are the most underrepresented minority in the nursing workforce. This is particularly of concern since the Latino population is the fastest growing minority group in the U.S. If nurses and the nursing profession wish to continue to grow in our cultural awareness and our cultural competency, then we need to include all groups in our profession and do what we need to do to actively recruit new Latino nurses to the profession. I urge you to read the article. I've linked to it in the show notes so you can check it out there. It's a great overview of the issue and a story of one Latino nurse detailing the trials and tribulations she faced on the road to getting her degree. She had to first learn English as a child immigrant to the U.S. in public schools that didn't have adequate resources to help her the way she needed. She had to struggle to get her college education since her parents were farm workers and couldn't afford to support her through school. Adriana Perez is now an assistant professor of nursing at Arizona State University. And according to the article, only 3% of the nation's nurses are Latino, while the population is roughly 17% Latino. By 2060, it's projected that Latinos will comprise about one-third of the U.S. population. So we need to do more to encourage and support Latino nurses and nursing students. Many of the reasons Latinos aren't joining the nursing profession surrounds educational challenges they face over the course of their lives here in the U.S. Challenges with the language hinder their ability to advance into higher level and college prep classes in high school, so they don't get the science and math background needed to go into a healthcare profession. Check out the additional points spelled out in the article and see what you can do to encourage people you know that are Latino students to come and maybe become nurses. Our entire profession will become stronger for it. Finally, in this week's nursing news, I found a great article on new avenues for patient and family education that's pretty cool. New video game style technology is now being used to help educate children and their family members about upcoming surgical procedures thanks to an initiative started by Stanford Children's Health in the San Francisco Bay Area. They collaborated with Lighthouse Inc., a company that creates video game style animations to create educational, interactive 3D videos that help families understand things like congenital heart defects and the procedures used in surgery to correct them. Families don't often understand the complicated 12-hour surgery used to correct these defects. They just sign on the dotted line and they trust the medical team. Now, this is not really informed consent or an educated patient or caregiver who can help with care after the surgery. So the use of this type of creative animation can be used to help many different types of patients understand what is going on with their conditions and health. According to the article, because the video education program is interactive, it allows the patients and family members to help complete the procedure in the simulation. And that interaction creates much deeper understanding about what is occurring in the surgery. Now, I look for other creative patient education techniques like this to crop up around the world as technology becomes more and more available for such things. And as nurses, we need to be comfortable using these things as well, since we are the primary patient educators out there, and our input and efforts can help shape the future of how these programs are used in the healthcare arena. So stay tuned here to The Nursing Show, as I will continue to promote these advances here, and also bring them to you in the future. Pharmacist Lisa Booz is back from the Maryland Poison Center with another Talks tidbit for us. This week on the show, she chats with me about what poison centers call one-pill killers. These are medications or substances that can be extremely dangerous to children, even in low doses. So check out this special toxicology segment with Lisa. It's coming up next. Hi, Lisa. Welcome back to another segment here, and I'm excited to hear about what you have for us in our Tox Tidbit segment this month.
Thanks, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. And what I'd like to go over this month is put a spin on pediatric poisonings. You know, we all hear about pediatric poisonings, and they comprise about 50% of calls to poison centers, at least when we talk about kids less than 6 years of age. So I wanted to go over the medications that we worry about that can be a problem when very small amounts are ingested. And I like to call them low-dose, high-risk medications. You may see them also listed as one pill can kill or one pill is deadly, but things that when a child takes as little as one tablet or one capsule or one teaspoonful or one mouthful, that they can be a big problem.
Well, let's go ahead and jump in then.
Okay, great. So I'll start with some background information, a little bit of statistics about pediatric calls. I already mentioned that about half of the calls to poison centers involve children less than 6 years of age. And most of our calls involve kids that are toddlers, that are in around the two-year-old to three-year-old age range. About one half of those calls involve medications, and these are usually pills, tablets, capsules that are left where children can find them. So they're left on tabletops, in purses, and often they're dropped on the floor or dropped on sofas and chairs, and you know, they drop out of pockets or drop out of medicine bottles, and then the kids seem to be the ones that find them most frequently. More than two-thirds of those medicines that children get into are adult medicines, and mostly those that belong to grandparents. So grandparents need to be really aware of keeping medicines away from children. Fortunately, most of the pediatric exposures are managed at home with the help of all the pharmacists and nurses at poison centers. And so EMS providers and healthcare providers aren't going to hear about a lot of these pediatric exposures. But it is estimated that more than 70,000 kids go to emergency departments each year for ingestions of medicines. And often these are the drugs that are toxic when just one tablet is swallowed. So I'll go through some of them just to so you can be aware of the ones that we hear about mostly that you know, we do worry about with just very small amounts. So first, the prescription opioid analgesics. These drugs are very potent, especially methadone, but also you have other opioid analgesics like oxycodone, hydrocodone, oxymorphone, hydromorphone, and also fentanyl. All of these are very potent opioids. There are many cases of pediatric deaths from ingesting very small doses of methadone. So this drug in particular has historically been a big problem in pediatric patients. But there are other cases of exposures to the other opioids that have resulted in serious toxicity or deaths. And even fentanyl, we are probably all aware of the fact that there are fentanyl patches, transdermal patches, that people will put on their skin for pain relief. The fentanyl is absorbed through the skin. And there are numerous case reports where kids have gotten into those patches. For example, there's a case of a two-year-old who became unresponsive after the inadvertent application of a patch on the child, and also a four-year-old who died after her grandmother applied a fentanyl patch on her to relieve pain. So they also are very, very potent. We also worry about the sustained-released opioids, particularly drugs like OxyContin, Zohydro, which is a sustained-release hydrocodone. These are a great concern because they often have very high dosages in that tablet or that dosage form, and you also see a delayed onset of effects. All of these opioids produce the same kinds of signs and symptoms. They cause lethargy, coma, constricted pupils, and respiratory depression. And naloxone is the antidote to reverse the opioid toxic effects. Now, another group of drugs that we hear a lot about in small children that we're very concerned about are antihypertensive drugs, and specifically calcium channel blockers. It's estimated that about 23% of adult Americans suffer from high blood pressure, and so these antihypertensive drugs are often in households where small children live, or maybe a grandparent's home where children go to quite frequently. But the calcium channel blockers are really of a great concern for us, especially verapamil and diltiazem. They are particularly dangerous in small children. As little as one tablet of either one of those can cause significant and life-threatening cardiac effects like bradycardia, hypotension, AV block, and asystole. Many kids who swallow these drugs need pretty aggressive treatment. We like to give them IV fluids. Vasopressors are often needed to bring up the blood pressure. Atropine for bradycardia. Calcium is considered an antidote for calcium channel blockers. Doesn't work all the time, but certainly is in our arsenal of drugs to use. And also, there are other types of therapies and drug therapies that can be used to reverse the cardiac toxicity. Another group of drugs that small children often get into are what we call sulfonylureas. These are drugs that are taken for diabetes, and a couple of examples of sulfonylureas are glipizide and gliburide. They're very commonly prescribed for diabetes. these drugs, that whole group of drugs, stimulate the release of insulin. So when a toddler swallows just one of those, you get very severe hypoglycemia, and not only is it severe, it can last for several days, so it can be very prolonged. Kids who ingest these tablets, if they're awake and alert and seem fine soon after the ingestion, they should be encouraged to eat and drink. And then we like to check finger sticks every hour or two for at least 12 hours, and for some of the formulations, even longer than that. If they become hypoglycemic, dextrose is given. When the blood glucose increases after dextrose is given, as it often does, the body just naturally releases even more insulin. So there's another drug that's called octreotide that we often give to block that insulin release. So they're usually put on a combination of dextrose and also octreotide. Another drug is clonidine, which is an alpha-2 adrenergic agonist. It's a drug that's indicated for hypertension, but it's also used for ADHD in children. Now, even though it's prescribed to children, adult doses as low as 0.1 to 0.3 milligram have resulted in bradycardia, hypotension, constricted pupils, and CNS depression. So they've become very lethargic and maybe unresponsive. Treatment consists of atropine for bradycardia, IV fluids, vasopressors for hypotension, and believe it or not, we like to give naloxone. It's not clear why, but naloxone has been effective in some cases of clonidine toxicity, even though clonidine is not an opioid. One theory is that clonidine's effect is mediated by endogenous opiate release, and so that's why the naloxone might work. It doesn't work all the time, but don't hesitate to try it if the child is experiencing toxicity from clonidine. And some other meds that are toxic in real small doses, just want to mention bupropion can cause seizures. Your higher strength tricyclic antidepressant tablets, you'll see lethargy, hypotension, tachycardia, and cardiac conduction delays. Chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, these are drugs that aren't commonly prescribed, but they're used for a variety of diseases like malaria, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis. And ingestions can cause cardiac and neurological symptoms. So we typically see hypotension, conduction delays, lethargy, and seizures. Camphor is often found in homes of small children as well as in grandparents' home. It's an ingredient in topical products, in liniments, rubs, and also the products that we put in vaporizers. Usually it's a liquid or a gel that's added to a vaporizer. Swallowing just a teaspoonful or two of some of these products can quickly cause seizures in small children. And then there are other topical liniments that contain methyl salicylate. That's also known as oil of wintergreen. A teaspoonful of a product that is pure methyl salicylate is equivalent to taking 22 regular adult strength aspirin tablets. So you can see how potent that is and how easy it would be for a child to become severely toxic, almost like they've taken a bottle of aspirin. There are more high-risk drugs and household products that kids might have access to. So it's important to realize that it really doesn't take a lot to cause a bad outcome, that just one tablet of a lot of medicines and also some other toxins, maybe a teaspoonful of a different type of product, household product, can be life-threatening when swallowed by a toddler. We need to recognize these ingestions early and provide good management, good supportive care, and maybe antidotes to prevent poor outcomes. Don't delay in transporting the child to the emergency department or in evaluating children once there. And certainly I'd recommend calling the local poison control center for help in assessing the potential severity of the ingestion and also for treatment recommendations. And just as a reminder, the poison center phone number is 1-800-222-1222.
You know, Lisa, it seems to me that one of the ways to help manage these issues would be to institute prevention programs and education programs for parents and grandparents, because then this is an opportunity for nurses, hospital centers, and EMS agencies to really get out in the community and teach people about proper medication storage and keeping things out of the reach of kids.
That's absolutely right. A lot of people just aren't aware that these drugs can be so dangerous in small children. They're commonly found in homes, and even say in the case of clonidine, it's a drug that is used in children, but it's a drug that if a child gets into an adult dose, then things can really change and the child can become severely toxic. So it is important to make people aware of the fact that these drugs are toxic. It's important to educate grandparents that most of the medicine poisoning seen in emergency departments involve a grandparent's medicine. It's important to use good poison prevention practices like child-resistant caps. You know, a lot of people have trouble opening them, but if you have a toddler around, it's really important to use those child-resistant caps. So, yeah, I agree. We can all work together to try to keep kids safe just by educating the public.
You know, and it's important to say that they're child-resistant, not child-proof. I have a family friend who couldn't open the cap of her medicine because of her arthritis, and she'd give it to her four-year-old grandchild who would open it for her. So
that's exactly right. It has to meet certain standards to keep a certain number of kids out of the bottle for a certain number of minutes, and I don't know exactly what those standards are, but if it was completely child-proof, none of us would be able to open it ever. So certainly we like to call them child-resistant and not child-proof.
Great. Well, Lisa, thanks a lot. This is great information, and we appreciate all the things you do at the Maryland Poison Center.
It's my pleasure, Jamie.
That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form, and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.